Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Finding Amy, a True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora, published by University Press of New England, Lebanon, New Hampshire. Copyright 2006 by Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. In the last episode, the trial of Russ Gorman was underway, and the attorneys and judge were trying to decide how to handle his mother, Tammy Westbrook, who now states that she can't recall her son's confession to her or her grand jury testimony. We resume Finding Amy on page 213, and this is episode 20. I am able to see parts of Tammy Westbrook's testimony. No doubt this woman is in anguish, and it is difficult for her, to say the least, but to sit there and listen to, "I don't remember, I do not remember, sir," is ludicrous. She has only lost her memory of the damaging statements. Stringy red hair wraps around a crazy face with thick eyeliner as Tammy swings in her chair in the box. I must admit, it is difficult to sit in that box on a creaky swing chair. A chair designed to enable the witness to move either way, to face the attorneys, judge, or jury. I've been in that chair many times myself, but Tammy is swinging in more ways than one. Stokes is doing the inquiry, and he's good at demonstrating to the court, in a calm and respectful way, that this is crap. Tammy Westbrook has a memory of convenience. How is it that you remember the police telling you that your son killed Amy St. Laurent, but you don't remember what you testified to? I wish I had the answer. Lily is heralding that she's suffering from PTSD. I really believe her, he says. It is ridiculous, I think, an insult to everyone listening. What about the PTSD of Julie and Diane, of Dennis? I think, sitting there containing myself. What about that, Mr. Lily? But that, of course, is not your problem. At 9:35, an hour later than they expected, the jury entered the courtroom, and the second day of testimony began with Detective Danny Young. Young was on the stand for 3 hours, being examined and cross-examined on the basics of the case, including Gorman's meeting with Amy St. Laurence, his subsequent admission that his intentions for the evening were to take Amy back to 230 Brighton Avenue to score with her, and the fact that police had asked to look at Gorman's vehicle, but were unable to. Young testified about the intensive search effort and the ultimate location of Amy's body. He served as the vehicle through whom the maps and photographs of the grave site, its location relative to Gorman's mother's house, and the routes from there to the location of the 3:14 a.m. traffic stop and the apartment at 230 Brighton Avenue were introduced. Young testified about the wooden form for pouring concrete found in the grave, which had been used to cover Amy's body, and about other such forms in the area. Some were located in an unused chicken coop, and others were beyond the end of the tote road through some trees by an old abandoned truck. Testimony designed to show that whoever had buried Amy St. Laurent was sufficiently familiar with the area to look some distance away or inside buildings for one of the forms. Young confirmed that at the time the grave site was found, the tote road was impassable after the first 25 feet. Young testified that he had driven the route from the 230 Brighton Avenue apartment to the burial site at 2 a.m., and that it would take anywhere from 8 to 12 minutes, depending on the vehicle's speed. He also testified to the detective's interview with Gorman in Troy, Alabama, on December 14, 2001, in which Gorman reiterated his earlier statement that he had dropped Amy at the pavilion, returned directly to 230 Brighton Avenue, and had not left the house again that night. On cross-examination, Clifford Strike tried to suggest that according to the maps and the place where the traffic stop had taken place, Gorman might have been coming from the game room, one of his favorite hangouts. He hammered on the fact that investigators hadn't found anything in their search of Gorman's vehicle, Gorman's mother's house, or Ryan Campbell's room to link Gorman to the crime, nor had they ever found the gun. Young was followed by Eric Rubright. through whom the state established the events of the evening up to the point where Amy, unable to find Rubright, had left the club with Sharma and Gorman, while Rubright, according to his statement, had returned to his rented vehicle and driven back to Amy's house in South Berwick. To demonstrate that police had considered and, on the basis of their investigation, rejected Rubright as a credible suspect, they also questioned him about his time-stamped receipts for food and gas, the fact that when he had reached the turnpike he had no change and the toll-taker let him on for free, and that he had written a note for Amy and left it with some of her things inside her house. After Rubright, a toll collector on the main turnpike testified about Rubright's coming through the tolls early on the Sunday morning that Amy disappeared, and his searching repeatedly for change until she finally waved him through and he headed toward the southbound entrance to the turnpike. Next to testify was Robin McKenzie, a friend of Gorman's, who had visited him in jail and corresponded with him. In response to the question, "Did you have occasion to talk to Mr. Gorman about whether or not he had ever carried a gun?" she stated, "He said he had had one with him all the time. I asked him why, and he said just in case. You never know if something is going to happen." McKenzie was followed by Travis Gilbert, a gentleman with a rather extensive criminal record, who testified that during October 2001 he had accidentally been released for a week when he was supposed to be in jail. And during that week, a few days before Amy St. Laurent disappeared, he was visiting some friends on Main Street in Westbrook when Gorman arrived and started showing people a gun that he had. Gorman said he believed it was a 9mm, but he didn't know much about guns. Mr. Gilbert was followed by Warden Roger Gay. Sergeant Gay had at the time been a game warden for 17 years. He was a canine handler and a Maine Criminal Justice Academy certified canine trainer. Gay described the various types of training canines receive depending upon the types of evidence they are trying to recover. Dogs trained to smell human scent and search for lost people. Dogs trained to scent gunpowder. And dogs trained to recover people who are dead. These last are cadaver dogs. On the day of the search for the body of Amy St. Laurent, December 8, 2001, Gay testified he was working with his 10-year-old chocolate lab, Reba, a cadaver dog, and was called to a site off Route 22, County Road, in Scarborough. When he arrived, he watched another handler with his canine working the area. The other dog went immediately to a location under a series of small pine trees, showed a lot of interest there, and then broke from there and began to case, searching. Eventually, it hit on the area of the gravesite. Gay then moved in with his dog, and Reba exhibited the same reactions, first hitting on the area underneath the pine trees, then breaking from there and relocating the scent at the gravesite 6 to 8 feet away. Asked to interpret this behavior for the jury, Gay explained that the dog's stronger reaction to the area under the trees, then a period of searching, and then locating a second scent at the gravesite suggested that there were two pools of scent. The stronger pool of scent was under the pine trees, suggesting that the body had first lain there and was only later placed into the grave. He said that for the dogs to have a strong reaction to the first sight suggested that the body must have remained there for some time. The fact that the dogs didn't trace the line from the place under the trees to the grave suggested that at some point the body was picked up and moved. Toward the end of the afternoon, the state called Justin Canny, who worked at Route 112 Auto Sales, where Gorman's mother's boyfriend worked and where Gorman sometimes did pickup work detailing used cars for resale. Canny told the jury that on the Tuesday evening after Amy St. Laurent disappeared, Gorman had arrived just as they were closing and began cleaning his car. Gorman had said he was cleaning his car because he had a date. He had also brought up the missing girl, asked if Canny had heard about her, and stated that he might be implicated, but he had nothing to do with it. The next witness was Adam DeVoe, nephew of Tammy Westbrook's boyfriend, Rick DeVoe, who lived the length of a football field from Westbrook's residence in Scarborough. Adam DeVoe testified that when Gorman moved up from Florida, he had shown Gorman around the woods and ponds area behind their houses, that they had fished in those ponds, and that Gorman later went there on his own. He also testified that Gorman had told him that if he found stereo equipment down there, not to touch it. To avoid prejudicing the jury, DeVoe was not allowed to testify about Gorman's offering to sell him equipment he'd stolen from customers' cars at work. Court adjourned for the day, with the attorneys anticipating that on Wednesday they would finally get to examine Tammy Westbrook before the jury. I would periodically stop in at the trial for an hour or so in the morning or afternoon, all I could manage with the demands of my new job. I have long been aware of Diane's pain throughout the process. We have stayed very close. What hits and hurts me now is how hard this is for Julie. It is so important for a family to be present in the courtroom, to remind the jury that the victim, the person who was killed, the subject of the trial, who otherwise has such a limited presence, was a loved and valuable human being, to be a visible witness to loss. But sitting through such a trial does not come without pain. Poor Julie, sitting on that hard bench in a room full of reporters, Gorman only a few feet away, having to listen to the strange and morbid rendition of the medical examiner's findings. Much as I wanted to protect her, I couldn't fully prepare her for that. What does one say? I'd like to show the jury photos of the scene and of the autopsy so they could see what Gorman did. I'd like to show them my favorite picture of Amy, and then the soil-coated mummy that we exhumed, and yell right in their faces, "See what her family got back? See what happens to a girl who says no to Russ Gorman?" But that, of course, would be too prejudicial. It would shock the conscience of the jury and thus offend the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause. It should shock the conscience. What about the shocked conscience of Julie? And then the coup de grace of evil. Gorman turns, stares, and smiles at Julie. Did I just see that? Julie is aghast, and a strange sound, a groan, a cry, lurches out of her throat. I couldn't believe what I'd just seen. Then a short while later, when we stood as the judge left the courtroom, he turned and mouthed, "I'm sorry," directly at Julie. Julie's hand flew to her mouth in horror as Diane glared at me, her eyes blazing, and said, "Do something." As Gorman was led quickly past us, it was all I could do not to reach out and throttle him. The gall, the arrogance. Julie rushed out of the courtroom in tears, Diane and Lucille following. I explained that if I attempted anything verbally, there would be a mistrial, that what I would have to do would be to report the incident to the prosecution, who could bring it to the attention of the judge. It was another of those things the jury never saw, would never even hear about until sentencing, if we ever got that far. It was one of the most disturbing parts of the trial, his face, his expression, and Julie's devastation. It was monstrous. While the newspaper ran stories that questioned whether Gorman's mother would testify about his phone call, she took the stand so judge and jury could assess her competency, and nattered on about her diarrhea, her stress, her meds, her weight loss, and how her lovely long hair had broken. Amy's mother sat in dignified silence and prayed for justice for her child. That evening, I would travel to Cape Elizabeth, a bedroom community outside Portland, where Lucille was making dinner for me and Diane. Diane was tired and seemed to be in a haze, but also peaceful and accepting of fate. She has such solid faith, it truly does sustain her. We gathered around a warm fire and sip wine, trying to avoid the case. It's like pretending there isn't an elephant in the room. There's the ridiculousness of Dan Lilly and Tammy claiming to remember nothing. I let out some of my anger while Diane stifles hers. Unable to contain myself, I get up and start pacing, blurting out a few unprintable comments about the system. I've lived with it for over 20 years, but sometimes experience doesn't help. It's maddening to watch these people continue to suffer so much. Eventually, we push it all away and return to our oasis of peace, a lovely home, the warmth of the fire. It's nothing we can control. At least the trial is moving fast. A few more days could yield the end of a long road. We clink our glasses and toast to Amy, justice, and peace in our hearts. Chapter 19. After a lengthy fight about the rules and procedure that would apply to Tammy Westbrook's testimony and how the trial would proceed if her memory could not be refreshed, day 3 commenced for the jury at 9:48 a.m. with some good old court TV forensics. Dr. John Berger, a zoologist from the University of New Hampshire, specializing in the biology of insects, took the stand to explain the significance of the insect larva found with Amy's body. Dr. Berger testified that he had received 2 sets of samples from the medical examiner's office, one preserved in alcohol and the other in vermiculite. La Rochelle. And what types of insects are these, sir? Berger. The 2 types of insects that were present were a species of blowfly and a species of coffin fly. La Rochelle. As to the blowflies, what was the significance of finding a blowfly on a cadaver? Berger. Blowflies tend to be the first insects that are attracted to an animal after it dies, and these insects, blowflies in particular, are important in determining the nature of death, time of death, and so forth, because many studies have demonstrated for particular species the time that it takes for particular species to develop in a cadaver over time based on different temperatures, different humidity, and so forth. La Rochelle. How long would it take for a blowfly to be attracted to a cadaver and deposit, I guess, the eggs, which would result in what you received in this case? Berger. I would estimate that given appropriate temperatures for development and for blowfly activity, that this process could very well have occurred within 12 to 24 hours of the death. La Rochelle. Now, are blowflies active at night? Berger. Generally speaking, they are not active at night. In response to Fern La Rochelle's questions, Dr. Berger stated that generally speaking, in a case such as Amy's, where there were injuries, it would take a post-mortem interval of at least 12 to 24 hours for a blowfly to arrive at the body and to lay eggs. He further stated that the body must be exposed for there to be blowfly activity. Blowflies, unlike the coffin flies that were also present, do not burrow in the ground and would not be found on a buried body unless it had been exposed for the requisite period of time. Dr. Berger was followed on the stand by Tammy Westbrook. At this point, Bill Stokes took over the questioning. Stokes's plan was to examine Westbrook before the jury so that they could assess the credibility of her claim of lost memory. He would then question her about her grand jury testimony. If her recollection could not be refreshed, either by referring to the transcript or by hearing her own voice as it had been recorded during her grand jury testimony, he would offer the transcript as past recollection recorded and have it read to the jury. Stokes walked Westbrook through questions about her current residence, where she was living prior to that, how long she'd lived there, with whom she was living at her home in Scarborough, and if her son, Jeffrey Gorman, lived there with her. Westbrook testified that her son sometimes lived with them, and sometimes somewhere else. She recalled, when they had moved up from Florida, that she had a kennel license to show dogs and breed dogs. He asked her if she remembered hearing about the disappearance of Amy St. Laurent, which she did, and whether she had had discussions about Ms. St. Laurent with her son. Westbrook answered that she was aware he'd been questioned by the police and that his car had been searched, that she knew the police seemed to be pinning it on him. Stokes asked her if her son had told her what he had done the night Amy St. Laurent disappeared. Westbrook responded that he had told her he'd dropped Amy off at the Pavilion nightclub. When Stokes moved into the area of Gorman's first altered version of the events of that night, in which he admitted not taking her back to the Pavilion, but said Jason and Cush had killed Amy and asked for a place to hide the body, Westbrook couldn't remember discussing it with her son. She did remember something going on in the woods behind her house on December 8th, that police had blocked off the road, and she had seen police cars. But in response to Stokes's questions, she could not recall receiving a phone call from her son the following day. nor going before the grand jury. Stokes, ma'am, do you believe that if you heard your voice on tape, do you think that might refresh your recollection of testifying before the grand jury? Westbrook, I don't know. The grand jury tape was then authenticated by Donald Mitchell, the court reporter who had been present at the grand jury hearing to record the testimony and who subsequently prepared a transcript of that testimony. Mitchell described the way that the testimony had been recorded, that he had made a shorthand version and also recorded the actual proceedings as a check on the accuracy of his transcription. Tammy Westbrook was identified as the witness who had appeared in the grand jury courtroom and given that testimony. Then the unexpected happened. Questioning Donald Mitchell about the transcript of the grand jury testimony, Gorman's attorney established that the reporter's certification, in which he attested that it was a true and accurate record of the proceedings, stated that it had been prepared on the 6th day of February 2002. The date of her testimony was February 8th. It was a reasonable attempt by the defense to exclude the damning grand jury testimony from the trial, and one the prosecution had anticipated. Challenging that typo, however, led to a decision that couldn't have worked better for the prosecution. The judge determined that Westbrook's memory was not refreshed by hearing the tape. When the tape was played for her out of hearing of the jury, Westbrook claimed she couldn't recognize her own voice. Having decided that the grand jury testimony should come before the trial jury, and with the validity of the transcript under attack, the judge decided that the tape itself was the most reliable record of the proceedings. Therefore, it, rather than the typed version of her testimony, should be used. Once again, the jury's chance to hear the evidence of Gorman's confession, which was the centerpiece of the state's case, was delayed. With the defense's objections to the admissibility of the tape firmly on record, the jury went to lunch while the judge and the attorneys bent over the transcript, deciding which portions of Westbrook's testimony the trial jury would be allowed to hear. Following a tensely debated line-by-line editing session, Bill Stokes left the courtroom to get the tape edited, having asked Danny Young to call ahead to the state's audio agency and tell them not to leave before he got there. Stokes was aware, as Scott Heracles drove him back to Augusta on slick winter roads, that he was carrying the only existing copy of the tape. While Stokes was getting the tape edited, Fern LaRochelle continued, like a goldsmith creating the perfect setting for a jewel, to craft the testimonial foundation into which Westbrook's information about Gorman's confession would nest. Testimony resumed at 2 o'clock p.m. with Robert Milton, manager of the game room, the pool hall in Westbrook, where Gorman was a regular. Milton described an evening at Denny's about 2 weeks after Amy St. Laurent had disappeared, when Gorman told him that he had been questioned several times by the police. Milton said he had responded, "If you have been questioned, what's the deal?" And Gorman said, "Well, they think I did it." Milton asked, "Well, did you?" And Gorman said, "No, I didn't." So Milton said, "Well, don't worry if that's the case. When they find the body, they'll be able to tell exactly what happened." And Gorman said, "They're not going to find the body. They don't have any evidence." Later in the afternoon, the state called Richard DeVoe, the boyfriend of Tammy Westbrook and father of her two youngest children. DeVoe told about a Tuesday night near the end of October when Gorman had shown up at Route 112 Auto Sales, where DeVoe worked, at closing time wanting to clean his car. In response to DeVoe's protest that it was closing time and his question of why the car had to be cleaned that night, Gorman told him that he was letting a friend borrow the car. DeVoe stated Gorman spent 20 minutes cleaning the car and then left. DeVoe stated that it was uncommon for Gorman to clean his car. Asked about a time when Gorman had wanted to borrow a shovel, DeVoe backtracked from his earlier statements to police, became fuzzy-minded about the details, and told an incoherent story about Gorman's borrowing the shovel to put in some fence in exchange for a piece of fencing. When pressed, he claimed that the words in the recorded interview transcripts were not his, that he couldn't recall his earlier statements. Finally, he admitted that Tammy Westbrook had been so upset that he'd talked to the police, she had made him sleep on the couch. On cross-examination, Gorman's attorney asked for and got confirmation of the difficult relationship between Gorman and his mother. Clifford Strike also established that the witness, Richard DeVoe, was no fan of Gorman. To clarify DeVoe's testimony, La Rochelle recalled Danny Young to the stand and asked him about his interviews with Richard DeVoe during the investigation into Amy St. Lawrence's disappearance. Young stated that on December 5th, he had interviewed DeVoe at Route 112 Auto Sales. In that interview, DeVoe had said that around the time Amy St. Lawrence went missing, Gorman had asked to borrow a shovel. When he was re-interviewed in January 2002 by Young and Heracles, DeVoe had stated that the request was a couple of days before or after Amy St. Lawrence's disappearance. The day ended with another conference in the judge's chambers. Fern La Rochelle, responding to Clifford Strike's line of questioning about Gorman's acrimonious relationship with his mother, argued that if Strike was suggesting to the jury that Gorman's mother had a motive to manufacture evidence against her son, he wanted another portion of the grand jury tape included in the testimony played for the jury, the part in which Westbrook, recalling the day after Gorman's confession, talks about sending her son money. Danny Young was sent to put the video editing on hold while the information about the newly added material was conveyed to Bill Stokes. Then all the weary parties went home to prepare for day four. Day four led off with the judge informing the attorneys that the deputy had just observed Tammy Westbrook taking some kind of prescription drug. Then came the moment everyone had been waiting for. Westbrook was sworn in by the clerk, and while she was on the stand, the audio tape of her grand jury testimony was played. Hearing the testimony in her own words, her reluctance, her pain, and the trembling anguish in her voice had a power and impact a dry transcript of the same words could never have had. You could have heard a pin drop in the courtroom as the jury listened to the voices of Fern La Rochelle and Tammy Westbrook. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.